Welcome, everybody. We'll get started because we've got a really full session and a very exciting session. To begin with, we wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands that we're meeting on, the Whadjuk Noongar people, acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region. Always has been, always will be Aboriginal land.
So I'd like to thank our sponsors, and I've also been asked to just let everyone know if you're going to the conference dinner tonight to bring your badges as they'll get scanned.
And I've done it again. We've forgotten to introduce ourselves as the chairs. So my name's Christy Newman. I'm an associate professor at the Centre for Social Research in Health at UNSW.
And I'm Jessica Botfield. I'm senior research officer at Family Planning New South Wales.
And so today's session is a symposium, and we were meant to have some different co-chairs here, people who are really sad that they're not here, particularly Peter Aggleton, who helped put this session together, who's not well, unfortunately. We have the single theme for the symposium, sexuality, education and youth, new directions, new priorities. We've got a longer presentation at the beginning from Rob, and then a series of shorter presentations that are speaking to some of these central themes, and we will have time for questions and discussion at the end of the session, so please keep a note of questions that you have. But to begin with, I think we'll get started. Can I please welcome Associate Professor Rob Cover, who's from the University of Western Australia for a little while longer and will soon be Professor at RMIT. Thanks, Rob.
Look, thanks, everyone. Can I likewise acknowledge the Whadjuk people and, of course, all Noongar people and all Indigenous people around the world who provide us very often with important and effective ways of thinking through many of the health-related topics we talk about at the moment. Now, when we were putting this symposium together, Peter Aggleton asked if I could do a little bit of scene setting. Now, I'm not sure quite what scene setting is. I think he probably meant, Rob, drop all of the complex theory, and we don't need to do that much Judith Butler and Foucault, and I try not to just present a whole load of data. So I actually just want to talk very, very generally about some of the changes and ways of thinking and ways of approaching gender and sexuality that are emerging from youth cultures, and particularly youth online cultures, as a starting point. Now, my trajectory on this is working from the perspective of quite often what we used to refer to as queer youth suicide. I'm tending to say gender and sexually diverse suicide because it's an area that in itself is very much in flux, but from the within the framework of identity, of digital identities, of the uses of digital media, of how these have an impact on population and population health, and so on. And some of this work appears in the new book, Emergent Identities, which was out a little earlier this year, and there are a few book flyers floating about if people want to have a look. I might even send bits and pieces of it, the bits I'm allowed to send out if people want it. Now, what happened with this work and why we're talking about diverse gender and sexual identities and ways of identifying and ways of labelling and ways of speaking and so on, a lot of this comes out of the Australian Research Council Discovery Project, Queer Generations, which is a project with Peter Aggleton, Christy Newman, Mary Lewis Wilson, Daniel Marshall and myself. We were looking at the experiences and understandings of support and belonging among two generations of young Australian people, people in terms of their growing up. So people who were born in the 1970s and people who were born in the 1990s. And we have these very specific generations for the reason that those who were born in the 70s were coming of age, whatever that should come to mean, were coming of age in approximately the mid-1990s, which meant this was at a period in which there was a particular framework for thinking about support and particular support around health education in the context of sexuality and gender diversity. That context is very, very different from now, from how our younger generation speak about it as well. So this was, to some extent, a comparative project. Now, the problem we had was we were actually putting this project plan together in 2014, and things have changed very, very substantially between 2014 and about 2016, 2017, where we were doing data gathering. In 2014, we anticipated a framework that had an understanding, a pretty much, not the idea that there is a fixed binary, hetero, homo, masculine, feminine, because of course we critique that in our work, and of course we expect lots of people to critique that. But we also expected people to do what they generally did in these kinds of research projects, which is fall back into that language and identify in that particular way. Now, the reality was that that did not actually happen, and instead we had very, very diverse identifications that were emerging. So this is not statistically relevant or meaningful, of course, but of our 120 or so participants, those who identified as male and female were, you know, from the 1970s group, say 15 out of 50 and 26 out of 26. So broadly the vast majority. But among the 1990s group, a much greater number who are identifying through other ways of, or other languages, in particular languages like non-binary, like a range of trans identities, terms like genderqueer and so on. The same thing applied in sexuality. A significant increase among the younger generational group of people using other kinds of identifications than queer, LGBTQ, heterosexual and homosexual and so on. Now, it wasn't a huge surprise that this was happening because this was really kind of on the cards, but it was the significant change among the generational grouping where we were seeing this. So it was around the significance of a shift between an older 19th century language of hetero-homo dichotomies and masculine-feminine identifications to those that not just recognise the complexity and messiness of gender and sexuality, to use Michael Warner's famous phrase, the messiness of sexuality, but the fact that this actually comes to be a way of identifying, a way of participating, a way of belonging, a way of doing engagement, and a way of thinking about rights, of thinking about good healthcare, of thinking about good education policy, and so on. So what we began to find, of course, and many of us in this room will obviously be familiar with this, others may not be, depending on how much contact we have with different groups, but hundreds of sexuality and gender identity terms along this kind of scale. This is a very good list that's been compiled out of our Tumblr settings. This is just gender identities going from A to D. So this is a small sampling of gender. Now, this, to me and to my generational grouping, initially, the sense is, this is ludicrous. How can we possibly deal with this? That's the first reaction. The second reaction is, actually, we do have to deal with this because this is a very meaningful change in identificatory practices among particularly younger people and then also, among older groups as well. And not just in dealing with this, but how do we incorporate this into the research that we do? How do we think about data gathering if we have to think about identities in this framework? How do we think about rights? How do we think about recognition? How do we think about inclusivity and so on? So there are a number of enormous issues that emerge as a result of this. This is the sexuality list is actually slightly smaller than the gender list, so I can put in a slightly bigger font. So this is from F to N, and has terminology such as the identity, I'm just going to go a bit randomly, menosexual, a little known orientation. Menosexuality is attraction primarily or entirely to people who are menstruating. It is the opposite of anti-hemosexuality. That's one. Limno, down the bottom here, experiencing attraction towards depictions of attraction, writing or drawings, but not the physical acts themselves. So it's a sexual identification that rather than thinking there's a gendered person identifying with another gendered person, a male, men who have sex with men or women who have sex with women or, a heterosexual identity, this is an identity that is formed regardless of gender, on the basis that the attraction is to pictures, drawings or writings of sex and sexuality. And it becomes a meaningful identity. Now, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, in some sectors, we might have talked about this as a philia, we might have spoken about it publicly as a fetish, but this is not really how a lot of the younger participants in our projects would speak about these kinds of identities, that they are no longer, that these are not add-ons, it's not necessarily a plus, it is the meaningful core identity itself. And the result of this is memes of this kind. Only 90s kids will remember these genders, so maybe we're looking at the last generation who will actually understand masculine and feminine. Of course, that may not necessarily be the case. We don't know what kinds of cultural and social swings and changes and developments and backlashes and so on will actually be part of the picture into the future. Rather, what we do know is that we're in a state of considerable flux. The frames of attraction are the other things that we're learning, and I wrote about some of this in Emergent Identities. We did start to hear about some of this in the Queer Generations project as well. The traditional frames of attraction, of course, are sexual and romantic, and most people have been able to, as long as we've read Cosmopolitan or Cleo at some point in our lives, to be able to differentiate between sex and romance with great ease, or not, as the reality, of course, very, very often is. But we've accepted these as two ways in which attraction is thought about and discussed and engaged with. But the language that's being used at the moment... again, among a very large group of younger persons in particular, but also not exclusively, involves at least six ranges or registers of attraction. So sexual and romantic, but also aesthetic attraction. The idea that I want to look at you, and this becomes part of the identity. So I might identify as sexually queer and romantically heteroflexible, but then also aesthetically limno, sensual attraction. I want to hug you is the best way of describing that, and that might actually also be another code or term or label or category of identity. Platonic attraction, I want to be friends with you, and altruist attraction, emotional closeness that is neither platonic nor romantic, but sits within a grey area between the two. So you have even a complexification of these different intersecting registers. So what we get out of this then is that it's not uncommon for people to start to use a range of identity labels that are broadly unfamiliar to us and that broadly don't fit with the kinds of data that we've been gathering for a very long time, in particular in health education and sexuality and gender studies. In the Queer Generations Project, among the 1990s interviews and focus groups, we had identifications like this. Phrases like, I identify as bisexual. Previously, I was identifying as lesbian, but then my partner was like, I'm non-binary. And I was like, okay, so I need to readjust or re-identify here. So see the kinds of complexity that people are thinking through. How am I going to engage in an identity label? How am I going to utilise the language that is available in relation to other people and how they are engaging with this terminology as well? I'm 22 and identify as asexual. So asexuality, which again has been a label that's often been the label without a label, the sexual category that's not a sexual category, that has been the exclusion or the pathologized category or the problem or the political rejection of sexuality, for perhaps, now becomes its own form of identity label as well. So I'm 22, I identify as asexual. So that was a learning process for me going through high school and just figuring out that something was just fucked up, but figured out a couple of years ago what it was. What it was that the label was not available to me at this particular time. So in the way that we used to have, say, in the 1970s, there are a huge array of examples of people who found that they were troubled at school. They were feeling fucked up at school because the idea, category, and terminology of gay or lesbian was not available at that particular time. This new language comes to replace, very much in the same way. So we're seeing something that is very similar, but also something that is somewhat different. I identify as gender fluid, demisexual, biromantic, panromantic, but I've always gone by bi, so I just say biromantic. I would like to study youth work probably next year. And I've kept in the second part of this quote because I think that this is very important, because this is a reminder that this is not just young people. This is people who are going in service provision roles, you know, in due course, you know, before too long. But that long string of identity labels. Now, one of the complexities, and one of the complexities for health service provision that certainly we're finding in a range of projects, is that the language is difficult to get around. And when we're talking about hundreds of identity labels, it's creating complexities for large numbers of people who are, for example, counsellors, general practitioners, and so on, in how can they respond and maintain the dignity of the client. How can we create? How can we avoid creating new anxieties by saying, "I don't have the slightest clue what you're talking about when you identify as gender fluid, demisexual, biromantic, but you really just want to say biromantic," and so on. So this is part of the complexity in this scene setting that we're trying to do. Now, I've got a couple of minutes just to say a couple of more things about this and sort of really where it comes from. I think that the first issue with this is really to say that these are not theatrics, and that is one of the first most common examples that a lot of people will make. I occasionally use my parents, who are in their 70s, as a litmus test for this kind of language as well, and I know that that's not a very good scientific approach, but that is very often their response. But this is just young people being dramatic, I think was the example I was given on the weekend on that Sunday lunch. So it's a common idea that this is just theatrics, it's just trying to be different, it's just backlashing against the old. The word "just" is the problem, not the word theatrics here. What it's missing is that these are, when we talk to young people, deeply felt, meaningful categories of identity in just the way that terms like gay, lesbian, bisexual, and so on, and queer have been in the past. And that they're not just online as well, that this is not just a matter of, oh, well, this is what people are doing online on Tumblr, but in the real world. And it's a common response to go back to a very old school way of thinking about digital media that is not really how digital media has worked since the late 1990s in most people's lives, that this is very much intertwined with the body, the embodied experience of relationality, sort of corporeal sexuality, corporeal gender, and so on, and ways of speaking and ways of communicating. So it's not useful to try and separate it from that perspective. So what we get then, and what this really is doing is pointing to us the fact that these are meaningful and that they do involve having to think about dignity, respect, and recognition, in terms of politics, in terms of health service provision, and so on, that they are challenging older ways of speaking, but we don't want to limit it just to say this is a generational difference and a backlash against an older generation, because that's not quite how it's working as well, and it's not as clear-cut as that. And we do want to acknowledge that these are having enormous implications, as I was saying earlier. Some of the common criticisms, I'll be very quick with this so we don't get loaded down, but is to say that it's simplistic, or to ridicule it, or to say, what are we going to do with the alphabet soup, which is, sort of another sort of older response to, oh, but aren't we just adding more and more identity labels into something that becomes less and less meaningful? Well, possibly we are, but possibly there are no other sensible, coherent, intelligible ways of doing this, particularly for some of the target groups that we talk about. Now, the second is political, though, and this did come up quite a lot during, for example, the marriage equality debates. The push against involving more complex ways of thinking about gender and sexuality that are embodied by these new labels. The idea that simple messaging is needed for simple political approaches in the context of the postal survey. Or that you get, for example, in The Australian, which is not necessarily the best arbiter of complex gender, or of anything, frankly. trying to talk about this in ways that narrow this down and get it completely wrong by saying, oh, these are a bunch of Marxists who are now adding a new language and trying to brainwash the world, and young people in particular, whisper them into particular ways of being that don't make sense to Mark Latham or others writing in The Australian. Slightly more substantial criticisms that do come from people like Lenore Bell, who's writing in the United States about this, which is that these are, in a sense, and I think we do have to accept to some some extent that these new labels and identity practices are very much, you know, what are Western middle class ways of identifying, that other people in other parts of the world don't necessarily have the luxury of being able to use or explore. So I'm thinking about countries of the former Soviet Union, for example, parts of South America and parts of Africa, where older terminology is actually far more useful for gathering and coalitional work and so on. There's, in some of the work that I do, I'm quite interested in the additional labour that is involved in understanding identities and what kinds of anxieties that these might actually create for some young people as opposed to others. How certain resilience is found for some in these identity labels, while for others it may not necessarily be the case. And what the additional surveillance that the use of these labels does. So there are quite a few somewhat troubling examples of people surveilling each other on Facebook, for example, saying, you know, but you say you're limnosexual, but I've just gone through your news feed, your profile and your photos, and I can see that doesn't really fit with that, and I think your identity is this. And that's a very much a different kind of practice, you know, than we've seen before. So there's a lot of work to be done around that, and whether that actually is necessarily problematic or not. Really to say very briefly in the minute or so that I've got left, that, you know, where this comes from is that this is an emergence. It's not replaced older languages. It adds on to, and it adds on to in ways that are in tension. But it's doing this through the framework of sexual citizenship, which is really about finding and ways that are not necessarily controlled or conscious or voluntary, but cultural ways of trying to find better ways of doing gender and sexual identity that can incorporate those for whom there have been gaps, for those who have been left behind in the languages that have been available to us so far. Now, very quickly, some of the implications that do actually come from this, I've mentioned some of these before, but the health service providers that I talk to, particularly in the Resilience Among Health Service Providers project, have been pointing to the fact that they're hearing this language as shorthand, but they find and that they're hearing change in labels between appointments. So people who might be developing an understanding of a sexual gender identity in that framework, but finding that it's difficult to keep up, it's difficult to understand the language. There are concerns around causing offence. There are concerns in particular for research around, you know, on that side of the spectrum, around trying to find more simplified language that can actually incorporate behaviour, as we did quite effectively with terms such as MSM, men having sex with men, to try and capture without identity, or to try and capture those who did not make an identity themselves, that this no longer necessarily fits if gender is not as simple as men having sex with men, or if sex is not as simple, or if, you know, sort of other aspects of identification and relationality are actually at play. So I should probably end it on that note and say thanks. There is more information around, and I'm happy to send out some of the material that we've got on this so far as well, if that's going to be useful to people. So thank you.